Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter made an unannounced visit Thursday to Iraq, saying he wanted a firsthand look at U.S. and Iraqi efforts to thwart the advances of Islamic State militants. As the insurgents overran Ramadi, the Anbar provincial capital, in May, Carter complained Iraqi troops showed no will to fight. But at the first stop of a day-long visit, the American defense chief praised Iraqi counterterrorism troops, dressed in their trademark all-black uniforms, as he watched their maneuvers at a firing range. The Pentagon spokesman, Colonel Steve Warren, traveling with Carter, told reporters the Iraqi forces, in combination with U.S. airstrikes, are in the very early stages of trying to retake Ramadi, now controlled by 1,000 to 2,000 Islamic State fighters. The United States has nearly 3,400 advisors and trainers in Iraq, but President Barack Obama has balked at calls from some Republican lawmakers to send American ground troops to join Iraqi fighters. Top Obama administration officials on Thursday are ramping up efforts to sell the Iran nuclear deal to skeptical lawmakers on Capitol Hill. The senior officials, who were key architects of the nuclear agreement, on Wednesday held private meetings with lawmakers in Washington. Speaking before a briefing, Secretary of State John Kerry said he believes the nuclear accord will make the world safer. Congress has until mid-September to approve or reject the deal, which will lift sanctions in exchange for Iran scaling back its nuclear program. House Speaker John Boehner vowed Republicans who control both houses of Congress will spare no effort to kill the agreement. This is VOA News. FBI Director James Comey says the Islamic State group's online attempts to recruit Americans pose a bigger terror threat to the U.S. than al-Qaeda. Speaking late Wednesday at the annual Aspen Security Forum in Colorado, Comey warned of the extremist group's intensifying social media campaign.
The threat that ISIL poses to the United States is very different in kind, in type, in degree than al-Qaeda. ISIL is not your parents' al-Qaeda. It's a very different model. And by virtue of that model, it's currently the threat that we're worrying about in the homeland most of all.
While al-Qaeda is now careful in how it chooses operatives, he said the Islamic State has cast a wider net and is willing to recruit unstable, troubled drug users. Comey said Islamic State-linked Twitter accounts have about 21,000 English-language followers, hundreds of thousands of whom are in the U.S. Kenya's foreign secretary says the coming visit of U.S. President Barack Obama is a strong endorsement for the country and hopes it will lead to greater investment. Gabe Joslow has highlights from the secretary's interview with VOA.
In an interview with VOA's Vincent McCorry in Nairobi Thursday, Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed said President Obama's visit with the government shines a positive light on Kenya and the administration of President Uhuru Kenyatta.
I think he's coming now is recognition of the kind of leadership that we have, but also a recognition of what Kenya has been able to achieve in the last few years.
Kenya's relations with the United States have been strained at times, especially when President Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto were facing charges at the International Criminal Court for their alleged roles in violence that followed the 2007 presidential election. But now, the tensions appear to be in the past. Mr. Obama is expected to arrive in Kenya on Friday to co-host with Kenya a global entrepreneurship summit. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
A Russian Soyuz capsule has landed at the International Space Station after a two-month delay following the failure of an unmanned Russian cargo ship. Officials said the capsule reached the orbiting laboratory Thursday, less than 6 hours after its launch from the Baikonur base in Kazakhstan. Launch of the unmanned mission to the space station was delayed after the April failure of an unmanned cargo freighter that was supposed to deliver supplies to the ISS crew. And the U.S. men's football or soccer team suffered a stunning 2-1 defeat Wednesday to Jamaica in the CONCACAF Gold Cup semifinals in Atlanta. It is only the second time Jamaica has beaten the U.S. team in 23 attempts. The Jamaicans also became the first Caribbean team to advance to the tournament final. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's foreign secretary says the upcoming visit of U.S. President Barack Obama is a strong endorsement for the country and hopes it will lead to greater investment.
That's Gabe Jaslow reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up also in the news. Bombs exploded today, killing 29 people in bus stations in the northeastern Nigerian city of Gombe. And opposition leader Agathon Rwasa today called on Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza to negotiate a unity government. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, President Barack Obama leaves today for a trip to Ethiopia and Kenya, homeland of his father, as he highlights growth in American economic links with sub-Saharan Africa. He arrives in Kenya tomorrow, where he will attend the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Nairobi. Later, he will become the first American president to visit Ethiopia. Human rights groups have criticized Mr. Obama's trip to Ethiopia because of the country's handling of political dissent. Late yesterday, Mr. Obama spoke about trade with Africa at a White House reception marking the signing of the African Growth and Opportunity Act. He said, despite Africa's challenges, Africa is a dynamic place with some of the fastest growing markets in the world. He said, the continent has the potential to be the next center of global economic opportunity. He said, the trade law will continue to encourage good governance, labor rights and human rights in Africa. Mr. Obama last month signed a 10-year extension of the country's main trade authority with Africa, a 15-year effort that boosted U.S.-Africa trade to $73 billion last year, with U.S. exports accounting for slightly more than half of the total. More than 40 sub-Saharan countries are eligible for trade benefits under the law, through which most imports from Africa enter the United States duty-free. Two of the main beneficiaries are oil exporters, Angola and Nigeria. Even as U.S. trade with Africa has grown rapidly, it trails resource-hungry China, now with $200 billion in annual African trade, and the 28th nation European Union with $140 billion. Mr. Obama has made a concerted effort to increase U.S. ties with Africa. Last August, he stayed the inaugural U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington. The U.S. says the Africa trade measures supports an estimated 350,000 jobs. As the trade extension advanced in Congress, U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman and National Security Advisor Susan Rice said, it has provided vital economic opportunities, helping African companies become more competitive and opening the path for more investment in them. Kenya's foreign secretary says the upcoming visit of U.S. President Barack Obama is a strong endorsement for the country and hopes it will lead to greater investment. Gabe Jaslow has highlights from the secretary's interview with VOA.
In an interview with VOA's Vincent McCorry in Nairobi Thursday, Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed said President Obama's visit with the government shines a positive light on Kenya and the administration of President Uhuru Kenyatta.
I think it's his coming now is just recognition of the kind of leadership that we have, a pragmatic, energetic, passionate, driven leadership, but also a recognition of what Kenya has been able to achieve in the last few years.
Kenya's relations with the United States have been strained at times, especially when President Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto were facing charges at the International Criminal Court for their alleged roles in violence that followed the 2007 presidential election. But now, the tensions appear to be in the past. Mr. Obama is expected to arrive in Kenya on Friday to co-host with Kenya a global entrepreneurship summit. With business leaders from around the world coming in for the meeting, Mohamed says she hopes to see some new investments in Kenya.
Everything is on the table. We're hoping, again, that a lot of investment will flow in. You know, we are taking center stage because the U.S. president is coming. I think everybody is interested in knowing what is in this country that is being visited and what can this country offer.
Aside from trade, another major issue on the agenda during Mr. Obama's visit is the state of security. Kenya, which shares a border with Somalia, has been repeatedly targeted by the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab. Mohammed said the U.S. has remained a strong partner to Kenya in the fight against terrorism.
Our collaboration, especially on security, is historic. It's been there. Of course, we've enhanced it a lot in the last few years because of the threat, the global threat, actually, that we all face. You know, insecurity is not unique to this part of the world.
Kenya has also played a role mediating regional crises, including the dispute in Burundi over the president's controversial bid for a third term in office. Burundi is still counting the votes from the presidential election held Tuesday, and Mohammed said regional leaders are still considering whether or not to accept the results.
There is talk about not recognizing the election results. We're consulting with the African Union, we're consulting with the East African community to see what the way forward is and to get ourselves out of the fog.
Mohammed also said she is hopeful for a resolution soon to the crisis in South Sudan, where a political dispute between two rival leaders sparked a civil war that has left thousands dead and has displaced more than 2 million others. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Bombs exploded today, killing 29 people in bus stations in the northeastern Nigerian city of Gombe. Those deaths and more than 100 injuries are being blamed on Boko Haram suicide bombers. The Gombe bombings are the latest in a series of suicide bombing attacks in Nigeria and the region. The attacks have accelerated since President Muhammadu Buhari took office and vowed to end Boko Haram's 6-year reign of terror. As the nation's newly elected president, Mustafa Buhari visited President Barack Obama this week in the White House in Washington, D.C. They discussed efforts to end Nigeria's government corruption and the militant Boko Haram's drive to create a caliphate in the nation's northeast states. On Mr. Buhari's return today to his nation's capital, Abuja, critics pointed out that Mr. Buhari did not return with a pledge of U.S. weapons. During a public appearance in Washington, Mr. Buhari said Nigeria's military lacked the proper weapon to defeat Boko Haram. The U.S. government is prohibited by Congress from providing weapons to governments accused of gross human rights violations. Amnesty International charges that Nigeria's military is responsible for the deaths of 8,000 detainees. Security is being heightened in northern Cameroon following yesterday's double suicide bombing attack that left dozens dead. Cameroon says the attack was carried out by two female suicide bombers. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Governor Mediyawa Bakari of far north Cameroon says parts of Cameroon's border with Nigeria have been sealed and there will be systematic control of all vehicles, people and goods. He says he has asked the military to be more vigilant and vigorous while checking travelers and their goods, adding that all suspected markets, shops, bars and popular spots have been sealed. He says he has also received instructions from Cameroon President Paul Biya to seal parts of Cameroon's border with Nigeria suspected to be used by Boko Haram suicide bombers and fighters. Less than 2 weeks ago, Mediyawa Bakari banned women from wearing burqa veils after female suicide bombers used them to conceal explosives in Fotokol on Cameroon's border with Nigeria's Borno State, a former stronghold of the Boko Haram insurgent group. Wednesday's attack was also carried out by female suicide bombers, one disguised as a merchant and the other a 9-year-old girl disguised as a beggar. Mijiyawa Bakari says they still found several wounded persons in the market Thursday morning.
The warfare told is Opito, Dr. Central, Dr. Bamari Funangi.
He says victims with fractures and amputated body parts have been taken to several hospitals, and he has asked all doctors and medical staff under his administrative area to attend to the victims and stay at their job sites. He says he has instructed all competent services to provide the necessary logistics for the wounded. Early this year, the Nigerian-based Boko Haram announced its allegiance to the radical Islamic State group. The attack in Marwa is the fourth in 2 weeks after Fotokol. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
16 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Opposition leader Agathon Rwasa today called on Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza to negotiate a unity government after the country's electoral commission announces the winner of the presidential election. Tomorrow, officials are expected to declare Mr. Nkurunziza the winner of last Monday's vote. Rwasa was one of several candidates who pulled out of the race and said they were not able to campaign freely due to intimidation. The United States and other countries have declared the voting was not credible. As head of the Coalition of the Independence of Hope Party, Rwasa appealed for negotiations with Mr. Nkurunziza. More than 100 Burundians have died in street clashes between police and demonstrators opposed to the president's controversial and possibly unconstitutional third-term attempt. In recent weeks, more than 150,000 Burundians have fled from Burundi, a country where more than 250,000 died in a civil war 10 years ago. In early July, the government arrested dozens in an apparent coup attempt. Rwasa urges those who threaten a second coup effort to join in seeking a political solution. Rwasa also asked foreign powers to pressure Mr. Nkurunziza into negotiations. The African Union says it is sending human rights monitors and military observers to monitor disarmament of the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing that is believed responsible for much of the violence. Amnesty International warns in a new report that Burundi is on the verge of conflict. This after police used heavy-handed tactics to suppress months of anti-government demonstrations that have rocked the country. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf has more from Bujumbura.
The report, Braving Bullets, says authorities repressed demonstrations as if they were an insurrection, punishing protesters for expressing their political views. Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director Sarah Jackson says the police response has inflamed tensions.
They used lethal, excessive force in responding to demonstrations, which then in turn became increasingly violent. And it showed that this was counterproductive, that instead of de-escalating the protest, this actually led to that intensification.
The UN monitors have documented cases of torture and ill-treatment of protesters in detention, as well as dozens of killings of demonstrators and human rights defenders by members of the Imbonerakure militia group and security forces. In the past 3 months, more than 100 people have been killed and more than 170,000 have fled to neighboring countries since President Pierre Nkurunziza announced his bid to run for a controversial third term. Burundi also has experienced a failed coup. Between May and June, Amnesty International's investigators documented police using excessive force against protesters, including women and children, to silence those opposed to Mr. Nkurunziza's presidential bid. Jackson notes some protesters were killed while fleeing.
The police shot unarmed demonstrators even as they were running away from them, when they posed no threat to the police or others. And even when children were present during demonstrations, the police still failed to exercise restraint. They used tear gas, they used live ammunition.
Amnesty did say some protesters used violence in response to the attacks by police. The organization is calling on the Burundian government to take action against those officers accused of attacking protesters. Mr. Nkurunziza is certain to win this past Tuesday's election after running unopposed. His critics say a third term will be unconstitutional. The president and his supporters argued that a third term is permitted because he was elected by parliament, not voters, for his first five-year term in 2005. Burundi's constitutional court has sided with the president. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Bujumbura.
During the more than 30 years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, the overwhelming majority of infections have happened during sex. Much has been done to promote safe sex, such as condom use, behavior change, and even abstinence. But the growing use of antiretroviral drugs to prevent infection has changed the lives of many people living with HIV and their uninfected partners. VOA's Jody Kepawa reports.
A lot of science has been presented at the International AIDS Conference on HIV pathogenesis, treatment and prevention in Vancouver, also known as IAS 2015. But one of the presenters was not a scientist. Damon Jacobs is a marriage and family therapist in New York City. For the past 4 years, Jacobs has been on PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Studies show the use of antiretroviral drugs dramatically reduces the risk of HIV transmission by lowering the amount of virus to near imperceptible levels. And when uninfected people take PrEP, it offers a lot of protection. Jacobs began his presentation by swallowing a single pill as part of his daily PrEP regimen.
Okay, 4 years and 1 day. It has now been 4 years and 1 day that I have been actively using PrEP, and as Dr. Grant mentioned, toward the end of 2012, starting to speak and teach and help people learn about this.
But Jacobs was not at the conference to talk about facts and figures relating to PrEP.
I am just so in awe of all the researchers here and all the research I've been hearing all week, but there's one thing that I think gets left out of these conversations time and time again, and that is the role of pleasure in these talks. Why are we here? Why are we still at IAS? Why are we still have 2 million new infections in the world every year? Because people are having sex for pleasure. Because people want to feel good.
The therapist says people want maximal pleasure with minimal consequences and lower medical risks.
If we ignore that or dismiss that or judge that or condemn it or somehow sort of leave it out of the room because we don't think it's really important, we're missing a lot. We're missing a lot of opportunities to reach out, to build that trust that you were speaking about, which is so very important in these relationships, and to help the communities that we care about and the people we love have these experiences that they want to have, the freedom that was mentioned earlier that they want to have. And it would be so easy to kind of forget about that.
While the acronym PrEP is short for pre-exposure prophylaxis, Jacob says it also means something else for users.
For myself and the actually now 7,500 members of the PrEP group online, PrEP has come to mean something very, very different. Well, not very different, but a little different. The acronym we like to use is proactive, responsible, empowered pleasure.
He says it means users take responsible action in advance to ensure HIV does not spread in the community. He says it empowers men and women to have full control over their HIV status.
After this week is over, after we've left Vancouver and those beautiful sunsets out there, and we've gone home to wherever it is, let's please not forget the pleasure component in our work. It is such an important part of life. It is such an important part of helping our communities heal and move forward and implement all these exciting, amazing changes that we're hearing about this week here at IAS.
Jacobs is the author of several books, including Rational Relating, The Smart Way to Stay Sane in the Crazy World of Love. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In advance of World Hepatitis Day next week, the World Health Organization is calling for urgent action to curb millions of infections and deaths from viral hepatitis. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Hepatitis is a viral infection that attacks the liver and can cause acute and chronic disease. It is often called a silent epidemic because the harm it causes tends to be overlooked. But the World Health Organization notes hepatitis is the seventh leading cause of death. It estimates 240 million people are chronically infected with hepatitis B, and up to 150 million are infected with the hepatitis C virus. Together, hepatitis B and C account for about 1.5 million deaths every year. WHO Global Hepatitis Program team leader Stefan Victor says all the tools needed to prevent the infection and deaths are available. He says there is a great vaccine for hepatitis B, good laboratory tests that can screen out infection in the blood supply, and safe injection equipment.
To prevent death, there's treatment. There's treatment for hepatitis B, which can control the disease, sort of suppress the virus, not cure it. Whereas for hepatitis C, there's now drugs that can cure almost everybody with hepatitis C. So it's really, that's been the most dramatic development in the last few years, is these new drugs that are really transforming how we think about hepatitis, and it's leading people to start talking about elimination of hepatitis as a public health problem in the future.
The cost of the so-called miracle drugs for hepatitis C are out of reach for most people around the world. A 12-week course of treatment costs $84,000 in rich countries. But Egypt has successfully negotiated the price down to $900, and the World Health Organization believes prices will continue to fall in coming years. The hepatitis B virus is transmitted through blood or other bodily fluids. Most infections occur from mother to child. Hepatitis B prevalence is highest in sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia. The hepatitis C virus is a blood-borne virus, which is most commonly transmitted through injecting drug use. WHO Service Delivery and Safety Department Director Edward Kelly says preventing unsafe injections is key to curbing this epidemic.
Unsafe injections account for 32% of hepatitis B infections, about 40% of hepatitis C. The most frequent medical procedure in the world today are injections, $16 billion a year. And the rate of unsafe injections of those $16 billion, we estimate, is about 40%.
The World Health Organization is campaigning for the elimination of unsafe injections by promoting the exclusive use of sterile syringes that are specifically designed to prevent reuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhuib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all, on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. President Barack Obama leaves today for a trip to Ethiopia and Kenya, homeland of his father. Opposition leader Agathon Rwasa today called on Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza to negotiate a unity government. And bombs exploded today, killing 29 people in bus stations in the northeast Nigerian city of Gombe. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, South Africa's female miners transforming the industry's traditionally macho culture. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports with Sunny. He is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning with Zimbabwe's team for the Special Olympics.
Yehiz, Zimbabwe has sent 15 athletes to the Special Olympics World Games, which officially opens Saturday in Los Angeles, California. From Harare, Michael Cariati reports, Zimbabwe's team has high hopes of winning a bunch of medals in Los Angeles.
The team has promised the harvest of medals from the biggest sporting gathering for athletes with intellectual and learning disabilities, which will run in Los Angeles from July 25 to August 2. The team has been in camp for some time, and head of delegation Viola Msariri says morale is high and promises a good display by the Zimbabweans.
They've been competing throughout the whole year, so our expectations is for us to come back with the medals, just like any competition that you compete in, and we are positive that we'll be coming back with the medals.
Msariri says a lot is expected from Nyasha Derera, who she believes will definitely bring home one or two medals.
Derera, for the track and field events, has been performing well and has brought back home a number of medals. And in golf, we've got Munyaradzi Msariri as well as Michael Mjiganadzo. We have brought back gold from South Africa and from Macau.
Derera himself has promised to make Zimbabwe proud.
My passion is to bring gold for Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe were last at the World Summer Games in Shanghai, China, in 2007, where they sent 19 athletes who brought home 16 medals in golf, athletics, and swimming. The country missed out of the 2011 games as there was no operational body of the Zimbabwe Special Olympics Association after the association had been deregistered by the Sports and Recreation Commission. According to Msariri, this time they will participate only in golf and athletics due to financial constraints. The seven-a-side soccer team had to be dropped at the last minute because of lack of funds. However, Msariri says they are lucky that they've been able to make the trip.
It's been a hurdle. We know the way our economy is performing currently, but it's amazing that we managed to put together resources that Special Olympics has managed us to be able to send a team to the World Games.
Over 7,000 athletes are expected to take part in the World Summer Games. The athletes will participate in 26 different sporting disciplines. The games will be officially opened by the United States First Lady, Michelle Obama, wife of President Barack Obama. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled Mandela and Music and Sports as Cultural Conduits for Unity. On July 18th, Nelson Mandela's birthday, I spoke in Frederick, Maryland on a four-person panel. We discussed South Africa's late president and how he used music and sports to promote unity and break down racial barriers. Among those who responded favorably to my blog post is Matilda Rosewood, who writes from right here in Washington, D.C. Matilda says, and I quote, "Sonny, this is beautiful. I loved your quotes from Nelson Mandela. You brought in so many elements, his optimism, his love of music and dance, the way he's being honored through volunteering and community service, and his belief that sports has the power to change the world." And then Matilda adds, "And you ended with a concrete example of that belief, the 1995 Rugby World Cup final in Johannesburg, where Madiba dressed in the Springboks rugby jersey and cap as a way of demonstrating his belief in the symbolic power of sports."
The Voice of America, VOA.
VOA's Jonah Haskell joins us now with an update on the Tour de France and the Gold Cup football tournament. Hi, Jonah.
Hi, Sonny. Mexico and Jamaica are the finalists of the 2015 Gold Cup after both sides won close games against their semifinal opponents. The semis took place Wednesday night at the Georgia Dome in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta. In the first fixture, the Reggae Boys of Jamaica shocked the favored United States 2-1. Jamaica took the lead in the 31st minute when a throw-in found the head of Darren Maddox, who directed the ball in off both posts for the opening goal. And then just 5 minutes later, U.S. goalkeeper Brad Guzan handled the ball outside the box, giving the Reggae Boys a dangerous free kick from just 19 yards, and Giles Barnes did not waste the opportunity, sending a blistering shot over the wall and past Guzan to double the Jamaicans' lead. The United States came out looking strong in the second half, though, as team captain Michael Bradley got a goal back in the 48th minute. But despite a number of great chances, the Americans were unable to equalize before the final whistle. It was the first game that the U.S. had lost to a Caribbean opponent at home since 1969 and snapped a 28-match home winning streak for the Americans. The Jamaicans, on the other hand, became the first Caribbean team to reach the final of the Gold Cup, where they'll be playing El Tri of Mexico. The Mexicans advanced with a controversial 2-1 victory over Panama in extra time. The Panamanians went down to 10 men in the 25th minute when Luis Tejada received a red card for allegedly elbowing Mexican player Francisco Rodriguez in the face. Panamanian players could not believe the call, and the replay confirmed their doubts, showing very little contact between Tejada and Rodriguez. But Panama played on, taking the lead in the 57th minute when Roman Torres headed in a cross off a corner. The short-handed Canaleros then hunkered down and held on to their lead until the final minutes when Torres fell on a ball on top of the box. Although the ball appeared to simply run along Torres's side, the referee called a handball and a penalty for Mexico. This resulted in play being stopped for a full 10 minutes as fans pelted the field with garbage and a fight almost broke out between players. Eventually, order was restored, and Andres Guardado made the spot kick for Mexico to send the game into extra time. In the 104th minute, Mexican forward Javier Orozco was fouled, this time legitimately in the box, and Guardado again converted the penalty for the final 2-1 margin. The Mexicans advanced to their eighth Gold Cup final, but the Panamanian players were not happy after the game, as the referee had to be escorted off the field by security, and their coach, Hernan Dario Gomez, called the match a vile robbery. The final will be played on Sunday in Philadelphia, where Mexico will be the favored team, although I wouldn't count the Reggae Boys out.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Cycling news now on the VOA. Stage 18 of the Tour de France took place Thursday as riders pedaled their way through the Alps from the small French city of Gap to Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne in the Arc River Valley. Frenchman Romain Bardet was the stage winner, completing the 186-kilometer ride in a little over 5 hours, while overall leader and yellow jersey wearer Chris Froome finished 12th, 3 minutes behind Bardet. Froome, who is British but was born in Kenya, now has a 3-minute, 10-second lead over second-place rider Nairo Quintana Rojas of Colombia. South African team MTN Kubeka managed to hold on to second place in the team rankings, despite a stage in which only one rider, Sergei Pauls, finished in the top 15. Stage 19 will take place Friday as riders will depart Saint-Jean-de-Maurien and continue working their way through the Alps towards the popular ski area of Les Cibelles. The 21st and final stage will take place in Paris on July 26th. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. The past two African football champions, Ivory Coast and Nigeria, recently hired new coaches. Frenchman Michel Dussier is now in charge of the Elephants of Ivory Coast, while Sunday Olise takes over the Super Eagles of Nigeria. Our African football guru, David Legg, spares a few thoughts on Olise's hiring.
Sunday Olise, the former midfield maestro who has taken over the Super Eagles, and on behalf of the Sunnyside of Sport, we wish him all the best. The Super Eagles at the moment not doing particularly well. Failed to qualify for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. They've had their problems with previous coach Stephen Keshi. 1 minute he's in charge, then he's out, then he's back in, then he's out. Then we're not really sure. Then he's back in again, and now, of course, he's gone. It's going to be interesting, Sonny, to see how Olise does. He strikes me as a man with a very sharp football brain. But I wonder if he's got that thick rhinoceros skin that Keshi seemed to have, and one feels at times that you need just to survive in that cauldron of Nigerian football. They've had very talented footballers, they've had good coaches, but poor administration. Olise, a most elegant footballer in his playing days, part of that great Super Eagles team of the mid-90s when they won the Africa Cup of Nations and qualified twice in a row for the World Cup.
Thank you, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. Joining us once again is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Jonah, the Gold Cup final will be played Sunday in the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, PA. The Mexicans are kind of rowdy in this tournament so far. Do you like them against the Jamaicans on Sunday in Philly?
Well, I do like the Mexicans over the Jamaicans generally just because they're a more talented team, but they haven't played well in the tournament so far, so really Jamaica could pull off anything.
And I gotta love that nickname, the Reggae Boys from Jamaica.
Yeah, and you know they're a good team. They showed against the U.S. that they can take chances and defend when they need to. So you know this final could go anyway.
So it's Jamaica against Mexico in the Gold Cup final on Sunday in Philadelphia. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahayas Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, converting hard copy publications into audiobooks in Nigeria. And next, South Africa's female miners transforming the industry's traditionally macho culture. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Batatu twibera mu mataba twiragiri nkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera umukuru muri twe akabinajorwa umukurikiye akabinarumikwa nanjye umuto muri bo maze kuba umugabo udaterwa kundi mwana wa shenge
yobayo
hey.
Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako numufindo mbambaroga afata inkone eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mumaze kuba bagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndeba bana banjye muri twe arazisingira zimunaniye zikikiriza ubuheta nangiuye ture nizana nkwereke araho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira Fata azikura ho wa murunga arazikonyagura imwe kuyindi dukora tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye nimuguma hamwe ntawuzabatera nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Manny Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba. Nigeria's schools, libraries, and smart devices have used audiobooks for many years. Now, in Lagos, a young graduate has found his business calling, converting hard copy publications into audiobooks for people on the go. Paul Ndiho talked to Tochukwu Nwako about his company called Genti Consult.
Tukuchu Nikocha walks into the studio to record the latest offerings in his audiobooks project. As the producer fixes audio levels, Nikocha reads through today's assigned pages. He runs a Genetic Consult, a company that is converting hard copy publications into audiobooks.
God be trusted. Is he really faithful? Is he as faithful today as he was in the olden days?
But you cannot rush God to do anything. Once he says what he will do, you can be sure he will do it. The second thing you need is patience.
Nikocha's company has been producing audiobooks for the last 4 years. They convert between 50 to 100 books a year. Depending on the length of the book, the process can take about 8 to 10 hours to complete.
Our challenge now is to move our content online, develop a robust online platform where people can access it as MP3 downloads, and also get more books done in audio without having the cost of doing that prohibitive to the authors.
Nigeria has a rich literary history with many internationally acclaimed authors calling the country home. Writers like playwright and Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka often interact with the local students and the young writers. Balin Ihondo is a teacher and lives in Lagos. She often listens to audiobooks when she's at home, and she has made them part of her daily routine.
I like to listen to this whilst I'm at home and doing my chores, because it's like killing two birds with one stone. So I'm doing my house chores, which I have limited time to do, and I'm also adding value to myself.
But the publishing industry here still faces many challenges. Access to books is still difficult compared to other parts of the world. Books are not as readily available, especially in rural areas, and where they can be found, they are often too expensive. Entrepreneurs like Nikocho are hoping to make books more exciting and accessible to many more Nigerians. The audiobooks cost between $13 to $18. Analysts say while audiobooks have been in existence around the world for many years now, they are an innovative addition to Nigeria's literary space that enthusiasts believe will inspire more people to embrace a greater reading culture in the country. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
South Africa female miners are transforming the industry's traditionally macho culture since the ban of women miners was lifted nearly 20 years ago. But sexual harassment is reportedly still a problem. Caroline Turner has the story.
Deep underground, Bernice Motsiola, a 33-year-old mother of two, represents a quiet revolution transforming the macho culture of South African mining. As shift supervisor, she leads a team of 22 workers at the Anglo-America's Bathopele Platinum Mine. She recalls the difficulties she encountered when she went down into the pits for the first time 13 years ago.
The men, they didn't like us. So they were telling us straight away that this is the main world, we don't know what you are looking for, and then now you said it's 50-50, you'll do this, you'll do half, I do half. And mind you, the first day or second day, it won't be easy to work like him. So actually you won't enjoy your job, because now you will sweat, and then if you don't do that, yeah, we told you, they will discriminate you.
Women have only been allowed to work in the mines since 1996, after an apartheid-era ban was lifted. Today, 15% of the employees are women. More than 3,000 of them work underground for Anglo American Platinum, South Africa's largest private sector employer, and they seem valued by their CEO.
There's lots of work where women are really good, driving equipment. Often women are better operators of equipment than men are. They're more conscious, they're more diligent, they look after the equipment better. So there are jobs that are naturally, that women are actually better at than men.
Dangers abound when you're traveling 350 meters underground, and for women, the risk of sexual harassment makes it even more difficult. In 2012, a female miner was raped and killed in another Anglo-American mine. And in March, a woman was sexually assaulted in the changing rooms of Bathopele.
I was like shocked and didn't trust this environment anymore, like walking alone, what if this happened? So it really had an effect on me as a woman, working as a supervisor, whereby in some other places I must walk alone. What if somebody just show up and I don't know the person? So yeah, it did affect me.
Safety was reinforced with surveillance cameras and biometric identification. And in general, female miners now feel more comfortable doing their job.
Up to now, so far, I haven't had any problem working here. The men I work with behave well.
Bernice and Nozuko both want to become mine overseers, an ambition that would have seemed inconceivable just a few years ago. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf
behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jokriak, and Major General Santino Dengwal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately. Because infected people have a much higher survival rate, if they receive early treatment at a health facility, compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.